Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by Executive Director, Mr. John Cohen. John, how are you, sir?
Great to be with you, Sean. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well, sir. Thank you. We've got a very interesting topic. One of the things we're looking at today is securing large events and the multidimensional threat landscape. What we want to introduce as a term necessarily, John, and start thinking about, one, why multidimensional? Two, the integration of, let's say, large events that require physical and different elements of assessing risk from different aspects, i.e., I think why we call it multidimensional, and how that integrates into both risk assessment, auditability, security strategy, and unification of many different, what I think has been considered in the past, John, kind of disparate areas of expertise, but it seems like we're getting into a vernacular where it's all coming together. However, we'll jump into all of those topics. But John, why don't you set the scene for us with, securing large events and why it's critical in today's threat landscape?
Well, let me take a step back, Sean, real quick, because I think your introduction to this issue was really good. First, when we talk about multidimensional threats, what we're really referring to is the fact that foreign and domestic threat actors, so foreign intelligence services, terrorist groups, violent organizations and groups in the United States, even criminal organizations, have fully embraced the power of the internet. And more importantly, they've come to understand that they can achieve their operational and tactical objectives when they integrate and coordinate the utilization of cyber attacks, information operations that are intended to impact public safety or facilitate criminal activity, and acts of violence or other physical world threat-related activity that's facilitated through the use of online capabilities or online tools. So we're seeing criminals and national security and homeland security threat actors increasingly use cyber information operations and kinetic operations in an integrated way. Secondly, we just came off an election year where law enforcement, election, emergency management, and cyber officials had to deal with a broad range of cyber and physical threat activities. They anticipated an increase in physical attacks directed at elected officials. They anticipated increased cyber attacks directed at government information systems, in particular targeting communication capabilities. Thirdly, they anticipated information operations intended to cause confusion, sow discord, undermine confidence in the election process itself, and they anticipated disruptive events such as bomb threats, swatting calls that were intended to disrupt voting or other governmental activities. And what they found throughout the year is all of it occurred. We had two assassination attempts against targeting a presidential candidate, the now incoming president of the United States. Secret Service and FBI disrupted a number of plots directed at government officials, government facilities, and political candidates. We experienced cyber attacks directed at state and local governments, in particular trying to disrupt their communications capabilities. We saw information operations, some of them including AI-generated content intended to sow discord and undermine confidence in the election. And we actually saw bomb threats directed at polling sites and other government buildings. And in fact, on election day alone, we had over 100 unique locations targeted for bomb threats, all polling sites. And a significant subset of those were part of a coordinated effort that originated abroad. So what we anticipated and what law enforcement anticipated actually occurred, but it didn't end on election day. just since Election Day, we saw the targeted attack of a CEO of United Healthcare in New York City. We saw a school shooting in Madison, Wisconsin. We had a vehicle ramming attack at a public event in New Orleans. We continue to see sustained levels of cyber activity directed at state and local governments, including a pretty significant attack at locations in Rhode Island. We continue to see information operations, and we continue to see threat actors targeting government facilities and major events with disruptive events such as bomb threats and swatting calls. So the threat environment was heightened before. It continues to be heightened. And so law enforcement has just come to conclude that when they have a major event, particularly a major event that includes, that's intended to bring together a large subset of the public, it's open to the public, it's in public, whether it be entertainment event or sporting event or even an inauguration of an incoming president, that they need to take the same multidimensional approach that they took during the election and employed effectively during the election and apply it to these events.
Oh, 100%, John. I mean, it's, getting to the point where we're starting to see, you know, crisis management, emergency management leaders strategizing with the requirement to have multidimensional perspectives when it was, you know, I'll say it this way a little bit loosely, John, but in some cases it was containerized to certain areas of expertise. You know, these particular physical elements are just going to be focused strictly on physical consequences. And now we're starting to see, well, we determine motivations from the digital footprint of others. And we're starting to use that telemetry in terms of threat awareness and building out capability in the space. And so, you know, that there is a requirement to shift to multidimensional focus for those in crisis management, emergency management, any type of preparation for large scale events. Have you started to see that become more the norm now, and that we're really trying to lead organizations down this path and they're willing and accepting necessarily to walk down that path in terms of understanding the multidimensional threat?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're hitting on a key point. You know, for traditionally, cybersecurity was something that was dealt with by the information technology folks, whether it be in a company, a private company, or a state and local government organization. Physical threats were handled by the law enforcement agency or the physical security folks, and information operations that could impact government operations. Or even the brand of a private sector company, there really wasn't a clear understanding of who was responsible for that. So not only were these types of preparedness and response activities handled in a stovepipe manner, but these folks have very often never even communicated with each other. They didn't share information. You know, you and I have talked about for months now that, you know, when we started our career, the physical environment and the digital environment were two separate environments, but now they're fully intertwined. And as you pointed out, there's virtually no area of threat-related behavior that does not involve both a physical world and digital environment aspect. So what we saw during the election, in the year leading up to the election, was, and this was the first time in my 40-year-plus career, is that these different disciplines were coming together from a planning perspective. I mean, some of the most interesting discussions, not to completely nerd out on you, but some of the most interesting discussions that I experienced in some of the collaborative and planning work that we were doing at CIS is when we got police chiefs, fire chiefs, emergency managers, CISOs, and others in the same room, and they started talking about how you would incorporate cyber activities into unified incident command during a major incident that involved multiple types of attack vectors being employed by the adversary. I mean, so in situations, and communities were actually prepared for this. Communities were prepared to deal with bomb threats directed at government facilities or polling sites that were implemented through the use of internet-based technologies. At the same time, perhaps a physical act of violence being directed at a government officials or specific facilities. And at the same time, the public safety answering point or the communication nodes of the jurisdiction that they relied upon to receive information from the public or get information out to the public or coordinate emergency responses were taken offline because of a denial of service attack. Those are the types of scenarios that communities across the country were prepared to confront. And this is the first time in my career that I've seen this level of planning consistently across the country by these different disciplines.
Yeah, I think it's the way I'll reference it. I think we've kind of had that watershed moment of where we've now this is the norm in terms of planning, as it were. Now we get into the advancement in certain areas where we're looking at technical capabilities utilized to enhance. Because one of the things I think about, John, in this space is the complexity of these events. You know, these are, you know, multimedia, live streamed, getting as many people involved as you can. So you've got, you know, concerts, we've had massive sporting events coming up that we need to consider, political rallies, conventions, you know, you name it. And the ability now, one, to address and reach an audience is not just, you know, I'll age myself a little bit. The concert was, you know, a piece of paper that was pasted to a wall, and that's how you found out about it, to now, where it's just a deluge of information. And it's, I think there's elements of information operation in that space, but as well as awareness, and then ultimately, you know, trying to appreciate the complexities that exist and how multidimensional needs to really abstract all of that complexity into an approach that, one, is sustainable and something that can be actualized. Because, you know, the worst thing we can do, John, in my mind, is, you know, have the written document, as it were. You know, we talk crisis management all the time, and we've written it, we've memorialized it, that's it. No. I mean, this is a continuous evolution, as it were, in terms of the threat and as well of what we need to do in preparation. So what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, no, I mean, if I'm a terrorist group or I'm a foreign hostile power and I want to disrupt the Super Bowl, I could send a mass casualties attacker to that venue or around that venue and have them conduct an attack. That would garner attention to my goal or my objective. But I could also disrupt that event by shutting the power down to the venue and doing that through a cyber attack. Or I could make it so the credit card machines at the venue site where they are serving food don't work. Or I could disrupt the communication, the television operations, so that all of a sudden no one would be able to watch the event. I can, you know, when we were working on the Democratic National Convention and the Republican National Conventions in Chicago and Milwaukee, one of the things we saw were hostile foreign powers using online forums to facilitate spot demonstrations intended to disrupt the convention itself. And those demonstrations were very often preceded by a swatting call that was intended to divert resources. Now, in both cases, internet or online-based tools were being used in order for a entity that was overseas, that was in the Middle East, to disrupt a major event in the United States. So, you know, when thinking about, you know, I've done a lot of planning for major events, you know, whether it was conventions, you know, political conventions or sporting events or other highly visible public events, events that are intended to draw the public to a certain area. And, you know, in the past, we were primarily concerned about a physical attack, which caused a lot of, you know, deaths or casualties. And that's still a significant concern. I mean, we just had the incident in New Orleans, where an individual, you know, was motivated by ideological beliefs consistent with the Islamic State, decided to take a car and ram people over and get out and start shooting. We've seen similar attacks like that in the past, and he was able to cause dozens of casualties. But you have to be prepared for more than that today. You have to be prepared for all of these other types of incidents that could be used by a foreign and domestic threat actor to disrupt a public event and achieve their operational and strategic objective. And I'll just conclude this part by saying that's how we need to look at the threat environment. We spend a lot of time looking at cyber as a technology issue and acts of violence, you know, through the lens of the threat of yesterday. We need to do a better job as security professionals in thinking like the adversary, thinking about, okay, so what is Russia? What is China? What are Russia, China, and Iran trying to achieve? What are the objectives of the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah? What do anti-government groups here in the U.S., what do they want to achieve? And then think about how they can achieve those strategy, those objectives through the use of cyber and physical attacks.
Yeah, 100%, John, because I think if we look at those consequences of not thinking that way. And I think, you know, this leads us down some of the red team thinking, right? Think, you know, that critical thinking space where you're thinking as the adversary, you're looking at their motivations, the ideologies, what they're necessarily bringing as an action on respective objective that they have in mind. So, you know, when I think of inadequately necessarily planning for such a strategy, or an approach and trying to do, you know, elements of threat modeling and trying to bring that threat intelligence to play, as it were, for this planning, you know, what are the consequences? I think with inadequate security, you've got the physical harm element, you've got reputational, there's financial, there's all of these other consequences that we need to consider and kind of build as part of our underlying program. So in some cases, John, you know, how do we help? How do we assist? What do we provide necessarily so that those people can necessarily understand multidimensional issues and then also prepare in a way that is leading them to greater success of, you know, building safety necessarily into these complex large scale events?
Well, I think the first thing that we or others can do is to make sure that those responsible for securing these major events have a up-to-date understanding of the threat environment. I mean, I talk to so many of my colleagues, you know, former, current law enforcement officials, homeland security officials, who are still thinking about the threat world through the lens of, you know, 9/11. And you know, that's important. I mean, we did a lot of really effective operational threat mitigation activities post 9/11, but we can't just look at the threats of yesterday. We need to better understand, to your point, Sean, the threats of tomorrow, the threats of next week, the threats of next year. And that requires a different way of thinking about threats. So the first thing, you know, I encourage folks and what we provide, you know, jurisdictions that we're working with is an assessment of the multidimensional threat facing the event or the time period which that jurisdiction finds itself. The next thing we need to do is we need to develop comprehensive plans to address those types of scenarios. And then once you develop those plans, you have to exercise those plans, whether they be tabletop or not. I mean, every single roundtable we participated in, and there were several dozen jurisdictions we worked with, where we laid out some of these scenarios that you and I are discussing, it led to discussions that served to identify gaps in their communication capabilities or their response capabilities. So it's not just enough to develop a plan, it's to test drive that plan as much as you can so you can find the gaps. Because you and I both know from what we've done in our careers that even under the best of circumstances, when you have some type of emergency or catastrophic incident unfolding before you, things are often not going to go exactly as you planned. So you have to have as much of that of those potential variables baked into the cake so that you're prepared to deal with these different issues. The only other thing I would say is, you know, people in our profession, whether they be cybersecurity professionals or law enforcement or physical security professionals, we need to start thinking about the world differently. I can't tell you how many times when I've mentioned that law enforcement's concerned about a denial of service attack against their 911 center, the response I get from cyber experts is, well, you know, a denial of service attack really isn't a sophisticated cyber attack. And, you know, it's something that can be addressed pretty easily. Well, that might be true. But if you are a local jurisdiction and you're responding to multiple bomb threats at government facilities and you have an active shooter and you have other threat-related activities occurring, and all of a sudden your 911 system goes down and your administrative lines go down because they're all running through the PSAP and the local telecommunications carrier has now just been penetrated cyber-wise, or a denial-of-service attack has overwhelmed your administrative and emergency phone systems, well, it's a very big deal. And so I think it's not just understanding the threat in a multidimensional way, but it's understanding the impact of the threat. And the same holds true on the non-cyber side of the house. You know, when we talk to state and local leaders, mayors, police chiefs, and fire chiefs about cybersecurity, you know, if we approach it from like a technical perspective, their eyes roll back in their heads. They start breathing deeply as they start falling asleep, and they're starting to think about all the many other real world things that they have to deal with. But when you frame the negative impact of a successful ransomware attack, denial of service attack, website defacement incident, or a penetration and exfiltration of sensitive information, in a way that ties it directly to their ability to provide emergency and non-emergency service. If you can't communicate with the public because your 911 system's down, then you're not going to be able to respond to emergency and non-emergency calls for service. If your work order management and customer relationship management tool is down because of a ransomware attack, or you can't access information in your city systems, and you can't issue business licenses, you can't respond to requests to the public, you can't take care of property tax issues, you're not going to be able to provide service to the public. And when it gets right down to it, if you're a police chief, fire chief, mayor, governor, county executive, county council member, your survival depends on your political and professional survival depends on the degree in which you can provide service to the public. And that's where you get their attention, when you can explain how a cyber incident, even one that's considered from a cyber perspective, relatively unsophisticated and non-significant, you get their attention when you describe the impact it can have on their ability to provide emergency and non-emergency service.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, in a lot of cases, John, it's to bring attention to these issues, because in a lot of cases, they may not necessarily have the context of, you know, that's an abstracted, you know, type of, and I hate to use this term, I'll use it, but it seems like they're, oh, well, you know, that's a fiction, that's a movie script. And it's like, I'm sorry, it's not. If we're not thinking this way, and like you say, going through scenario development, tabletop, roundtable, even simulation exercises in this space, if we have that same perspective, we're never going to learn ultimately. And we want to necessarily build a capability, build a resilience. And I think, you know, maybe this will be a touch controversial, but I think at this point, John, my necessarily request or where I'm thinking that personnel with this type of responsibility is you can't just assume cyber is a technical issue. You've got to understand and at least have an appreciation. And then I think we've got to do that on the cyber side, as well as bringing in the physical assessment strategy. And we've got to be multidisciplined ourselves in our learning and really starting to bring that type of mentality to the table. It's not, this is your problem, you know, you solve it from these types of perspectives. No, this is a shared risk that we all need to necessarily address together. And we each have a responsibility to, I say, understand everyone across the table from these different dimensions, as it were. Because if we don't, and we're not going to be able to meet or discuss at that level, I think we're either going to be talking over people's heads and it's not going to make any sense. Like you say, the deep sighs and the closed eyes is not what we need. We want to get everybody, you know, kind of moving towards this preparedness. And I think ultimately that's where resilience starts to be built. And not resilience dependent on, you know, I'm going to transfer that to somebody else because that's their responsibility. I don't think that's justified in today's threat landscape. But any thoughts on that? Those points, John?
I totally agree with you. I mean, and I think the good news is that I'm beginning to see that shift in thinking, at least in you know, in the world that I operate in, I spend a lot of time talking to police chiefs, sheriffs, the head of state police agencies, you know, law enforcement officials and emergency managers, and they're beginning to see the world the same way that you just described. And, you know, if I can just, again, not to, to sort of wave the CIS flag, but in part, in large part, that's because we've been out there driving this message. I mean, you know, I spend, and others at CIS spend a huge amount of time providing briefings to state and local officials around the country. And we, you know, my team spends a lot of time developing and providing threat briefings that we are communicating and presenting either in very localized events or in national events. I'll give you an example. I did a presentation yesterday with our election infrastructure, ISAC, which we host here at CIS, briefed election officials from around the country. Afterwards, I received requests from different states to come in and give a more detailed briefing of what I presented yesterday to their emergency managers, law enforcement, and election officials across the state. So, I mean, I think the first piece of good news is that that awareness is building. The other piece of good news is that we've just come off a year where, as I mentioned earlier, we had a significant level of cyber and physical threat activity relating to the election, but we didn't experience any major disruptions to the point where some people are saying, well, you see, everyone was all concerned and nothing happened. No, things happened. A lot of things happened. A lot of really bad things happened, but our local communities were prepared. They had plans. They were able to execute those plans. You know, in one case, in some cases, you had states that were targeted with AI-generated video content that was pushed out online, you know, supposedly depicting ballots being destroyed, and the effort was trying to undercut the confidence in the results of the election. And that state detected that content and very quickly put in place a crisis communication plan to debunk it. And even so, before that content could go viral, that state had taken the actions to undermine the information operations. You know, they had the state and locals, they were prepared, they had plans, and they executed on those plans. And so when we had bomb threats directed at polling sites, we didn't have any major disruptions in voting, because law enforcement had a plan to go in there, do what they had to do to make sure the location was secure. And the election officials working with law enforcement had a plan to keep voting going. I mean, that says a lot. And so that tells me that we are making progress in sort of educating those folks out there who have to deal with these types of threats on a day-to-day basis. I was, you know, you and I were talking earlier about this. You know, I've had some visibility into the planning for the upcoming for the inauguration for Donald Trump, and the folks that are involved in that planning adopted a multidimensional approach. They're preparing for cyber attacks. They're preparing for disruptive demonstrations that are being facilitated and organized from parties abroad. They are preparing themselves for acts of violence. They prepared themselves to deal with disruptive events, bomb threats, and others. The good news is that it does require change, but that change seems to be taking place at the state and local level.
And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break. Are you a U.S. state, local, tribal, or territorial government organization? Well, if so, you know how remote and hybrid work models make it really difficult to protect your endpoints and manage your vulnerabilities? Well, this is where CIS Endpoint Security Services can help. Now available exclusively to U.S. SLTTs like yours, CIS ESS deploys directly on endpoint devices to help you identify, detect, respond to, and remediate endpoint security incidents and alerts. Now it works in partnership with our 24/7/365 CIS Security Operations Center, which analyzes threat detections and notifies you of actionable endpoint security incidents, all within 5 minutes. Now, ESS also comes with add-on and standalone capabilities that provide real-time insight into vulnerability and mobile devices, including those of subordinate organizations you oversee. So strengthen your endpoint defenses today by visiting cisecurity.org.
Thank you. And let's jump back into the episode.
Now, one of the other elements, John, that we'll finish on is it's the velocity of this type of information is absolutely incredible. It's not just we've done a plan, we'll just, you know, rinse and repeat and we're good for the next. It's a totally different, you know, I mean, you can look hourly and the landscape is changing. Now, one of the things, you know, that I integrate as part of risk assessment and audit necessarily of crisis, emergency and preparedness and scenarios is to, you know, abstract necessarily what exists in terms of the threat intelligence, receive that, consume, you know, kind of rinse and repeat that process down the line. What are we recommending? What are we charging others in the community with this responsibility with in order to, one, understand, two, consume, and three, be really aware of kind of current threat elements that they need to consider as they start to develop and build out such plans?
Yeah, so we're handling it using sort of three approaches. We do quite a bit of work where we develop trends at long, you know, forward-looking trends analysis. I mean, we just recently released an analysis or an assessment of how the threat environment will evolve, over the course of 2025 and what state and local jurisdictions can anticipate having to deal with from a multidimensional threat perspective. We also organized around those concepts, provide a weekly threat update that's available for a very nominal charge. We are a nonprofit, but I am required to find ways to offset some of my operating costs. So for a nominal charge, you know, a subscriber can gain access to a roundup of major cyber threats, physical threats, information operations, you know, the same type of stuff we've been discussing throughout this. What we also do, though, and this is something that I'm extraordinarily proud of, we have become a state and local law enforcement depend on us to provide real-time threat reporting. And essentially, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, you know, the CIS team is looking at emerging threats, and we are getting that information out in real time to state and local law enforcement organizations around the country. Because you said something really, really important. Look, I used to run the Office of Intelligence and Analysis at DHS, and I'm very proud of the men and women that work there. But you can't take 3 to 5 days to report on an emerging threat, because the threat environment is evolving at, you know, not to be cute, but is evolving at internet speed. And to stay with the analogy, you cannot, you know, we in law enforcement or in the analytic community cannot operate at analog speed. So, you know, one of the things that I'm really proud of that we've done is that we have become that trusted source for real-time threat reporting. And sometimes it's a trend, you know, sometimes it concerns a group of people, stating they're articulating an intent to engage in activity that could impact a broad range of jurisdictions. But we also have discovered very specific threats directed at very specific targets in a single jurisdiction that we have been able to share with that jurisdiction and prevent that threat from occurring.
Yeah, wonderful. John, as always, absolutely phenomenal. I appreciate you being on the podcast. We are going to follow up. One of the things I do want to take a look at is the threat product, ThreatWar. I want to look at the integration of that into such a planning capability, and then what that means to continuously update and the types of information that's provided there. I think that'll be useful for those either considering or actually using it today as to actualize that information and operationalize necessarily as part of such planning.
No, and if there are any listeners that, you know, have an want more information on ThreatWA prior to that podcast, that discussion, they can go to the CIS website. But Sean, you know I love appearing on this with you. It's a great forum, and you know, and so far my experiences have been great discussions. So I look forward to more opportunities.
Wonderful. Thank you, John. I really appreciate it. And for our audience, any questions, comments, concerns, and thoughts, podcast@cisecurity.org. So join us every Wednesday for episodes like this and much, much more. With that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.